Good evening. Just allow me two sort of prefatory comments before I get started. Last night at dinner, Mark Jarzombek commented on the structuralist nature of my explication of structuralism. And what I understand him to mean by that is, like any good materialist who's interested in the historical and social consequences of what purports to be an ahistorical enterprise, Mark was asking, as I understand it, for an account of what was external to the radically closed formal universe of structuralism. We could say, what is it that structures structuralism? And with this sort of question and the position behind it, I certainly agree and will try to begin to address tonight and Friday night. And as a result, we'll no longer be able to sort of entirely conceal a certain partisanship here, the partisanship which is revealed perhaps in the title tonight, Ideology and the Production of Meaning, because what we want to begin to consider is how structuralists propose, and begin to criticize as well, how structuralists propose to work within this radical formalism and escape ideology. The second comment is, since I take it that by now only the most dedicated and committed remain, I want to talk a bit by focusing the discussion on what some of you may find to be too narrow a field. Tonight I really want to talk about three texts from which I will have to quote extensively, and I apologize for that, but it's just sort of necessary to read a lot of quotations tonight to get at some of this material. But before I scare you off with the mention of text, let me quickly show a slide. That signifying practice is made possible by the existence of a system or infrastructure of conventions, rules, and relations within which the signs of a signifying practice must function. Structuralism's vocation, or structuralist criticism's vocation, is most often to produce a model of this system, a model of this network. Its object of analysis can be any signifying practice. We talked a little bit last night not only about architecture, maybe film, even anthropology, and including architecture, but its foundational analogy is to linguistics, and hence there arose inevitably within structural analyses of architecture the notion of a return to the architectural language. And I actually anticipated or got ahead of myself a bit last night by already using that phrase, the architectural language. In a 1977 essay entitled The Beauty of Shadows, Jorge Silvetti articulates the general tendency of architectural theory in the 70s to look to structuralist studies of language as a possible paradigm for architectural thought. And he develops a theory now not of architectural criticism, but rather of architectural production, of design production based on structuralist principles, which he calls criticism from within. He outlines his premises, and here's the first of the quotations. Silvetti says, "This return to language is marked by an unusual degree of self-consciousness in architecture, which starts with a recognition that architecture, like any cultural product, can be studied as a system of signification, establishing different levels, accumulating layers of meaning and sense, and constituting one of the many symbolic spheres instituted by society. As a consciousness of itself, architecture can only and only willingly operate with the known, with what is already known, its past, immediate or distant, and the existent world." This by now should be very familiar with all the talk of Venturi. "It is then," Silvetti continues, "a work of reflection. Architecture is a work of reflection, one which automatically establishes a basis for criticism, since criticism is a speculative reflection on the known." And now, listen at that. Architecture is then a work of reflection which automatically establishes a basis for criticism, since criticism is just this speculative reflection on the known. Now, it's a useful list of polemical assertions, a fairly articulate description of what many in the late 70s felt to be the working conditions of current architectural practice, and it can provide the preliminary terms for our consideration of the notion of the production of architectural meaning now within design practice. There are a few distinctions worth making and a few stresses worth laying on from the start. First is the distinction between what Silvetti's calling criticism from within, which takes place within the nonverbal practice of architectural design, the distinction between that and critical commentary, we might call it, understood in the more traditional mode of verbal explication or verbal criticism. Now, here Silvetti is relying on Michel Foucault, who opposed criticism and criticism against commentary, and argued that commentary essentially reproduces the work or reproduces the language under analysis. And in reproducing it, it sanctions its legitimacy. It even sanctions its truth in an effort to somehow, through a verbal critical language, to conjure up a glimpse of the thing itself, to somehow represent, redescribe, and conjure up an image of the thing that's being commented on, the particular, unique, unified architectural object. Criticism, as opposed to commentary, criticism itself, said Foucault, on the other hand, judges the language and profanes the language. Those are Foucault's words. Now, profanes it, we might understand to be something like Venturi is doing, in the sense that it judges the language, it puts the language again back in the world, back into a context from which it can be criticized rather than just commented on. Now, criticism from within, then, is both a re-presentation of architectural language, but also ostensibly or claims to be a subversion of the conventional materials available to architects or conventional design procedures. What Roland Barthes called criticism from within, we could imagine Roland Barthes calling a mask that points a finger at itself. So somehow a fiction that acknowledges the fact that it is a fiction. Second, in Silvetti, in the quotation I read, is the distinction between criticism and mythification. Now, Silvetti here follows again Barthes, who in the essay Myth Today presents a semiological analysis of the mechanisms by which myth sort of insinuates itself into our perception and thought. And now myth in Barthes' case is not actually related to Levi-Strauss myth. What Barthes means by myth is the myth of the kind of myths under which popular culture operates. Like Barthes' myth, the architecture of the 70s, this is Barthes speaking, is made of material which has already been worked on so as to make it suitable for communication. Mythification, then, appears as what Barthes called a second-order semiological system. You could refer to the graph, in which the sign of the first-order language, that the sign that is the unit of signifier and signified, or image and concept, which we can see in the first bottom row, produces a meaning or produces a concept, which in turn then the concept itself becomes a signifier in a second level, a signifier or a form of the second level mythical concept. And then together, the form and that concept produces a third level mythical signification. The first order sign is thus impoverished, as we saw last night, depleted, but in that impoverishment and in that depletion, in becoming the form, is split off from its signified, in becoming the form of the mythical concept, it can only then refer to some larger global signification, which Barthes is calling myth. So think, for example, of a first-order signifier, say a keystone, which has as its signified an arch, and with that first-order signifier and signified, the keystone and the arch produces as its meaning, we could say, or as its concept, the condition of entry. And so here Graves is relying on that first order signifier and its concept of arch to and its signified arch to produce the concept of entry, and actually little else here perhaps produces the concept of entry. So the keystone then is a sign of entry. Now this unit, this sign, this second order sign, becomes in second order myth a mere formal signifier, which has as its signification the global system of classical language, and that's Graves' famous sort of analysis that by using bits and pieces of the classical language, one could refer to the global system of classicism. This is a page from Silvetti's essay. Now, for Silvetti, criticism from within is also a second-order signifying system, but one whose signified is itself a signifying system, that is, architectural language. So somehow Loos's column or the other columns that you see here stand as signifiers whose signifieds is itself another signifying system, which is classical language and architectural language. What Silvetti seems to aim at here in making these distinctions is not so much an analysis then of any particular instance of architecture, so much as the very mechanisms by which elements of the architectural language are lifted out of their historical sediment, out of their originary contexts, and recombined or transformed or distorted or exaggerated into the language's various instances. And then in this lifting out and recombination, thereby ultimately forms sort of constellations or groupings of related structures and strategies, each producing different effects. You know, the different columns or the different uses of keystones produce different effects, but all of these effects are already latent in the language, even though they're heretofore unrealized. So if we think of someone like Rossi, who endlessly combines not only appropriated bits and pieces from the architectural language, but even reappropriates his own work and recombines it, or if we think of someone, again, like Graves, appropriating, perhaps we could say, a kind of Corbusian language, but producing different effects than Corbusier himself produced, but effects that were already latent in that language, even though heretofore unrealized. Silvetti summarized this in the statement that I read, architecture can only and only willingly operate with the known. And the exemplary operation that exemplary effect that Silvetti wants to get here is the one that Lévi-Strauss had already identified in Duchamp's Ready-Mades. This is Lévi-Strauss speaking of the Ready-Mades. He says, Duchamp then accomplishes a new distribution between the signifier and the signified, a distribution that was in the realm of the possible of the two separate parts. I mean, it's possible for a bicycle wheel to mean that. It just hadn't meant that before. Was possible in the realm of the possible, but was not openly in effect. One makes then, in a sense, a work of learning. Now that's important, that one makes a cognitive object. One makes an object which itself has a cognitive dimension, discovering in that object latent properties that were not perceived in the object's initial context. So what's at issue here, then, is a positing of a single set of categories or single groups of operations into which the various individual empirical instances of architecture can be translated. Silvetti put it this way, those operations performed on the elements of a given existent code which depart from the original normative and canonical usage of the code by distorting, regrouping, reassembling, or in general altering it such that, in such a way that it maintains its reference to the original, think of both Duchamp and Graves, it maintains its reference to the original while tending to produce a new meaning. Now Silvetti suggests that the classical rhetorical figures, certain classical rhetorical figures, as possible transformations, transformational operations. For example, the rhetorical figure of hyperbole might be appropriate for Graves' Snyderman House. Hyperbole, the kind of exaggeration of the Corbusian language, or hyperbole, or the rhetorical category of irony for Giulio's Palazzo del Te. These are syntactic transformations on the given codes. Or the category of ellipsis of Rossi, or or the kind of leaving out a lot of information so that only the bare remains. It's an elliptical reference of Rossi. Or we might think of the rhetorical operation of paradox as naming the operations of the stair in Vanna Venturi House, where the paradoxical combination of a fireplace and a stair, or the paradox it's within the stair itself, that it's a stair that at the top, you remember, the sort of stair that goes nowhere, the paradox of a stair that you don't walk on but rather put books on. Or in the case of Rossi, also the kind of elliptical device of the Teatro del Mondo. Now, such transformations constitute what Silvetti calls a meta-language, a language at a higher order than the original language, an intrinsic and non-verbal sort of criticism. This is criticism from within, not verbal commentary from outside. This criticism from within seeks to replace the various architectural figures that arose out of determinate, functional, historical, constructional, social conditions, as it were, with a kind of hypothetical. We imagine the sort of architecture of Venice arising out of certain economic, social, and historical conditions, but Rossi seems to take that and refer to it, but cut that architecture off from those conditions, producing, as it were, a hypothetical description of this underlying system of formal relations by which we now can understand the architecture of Venice as having been constituted, but we only understand it after we see Rossi's. We understand the architectural system differently after we see Rossi's metalinguistic commentary on it. Now, at this stage, however, Silvetti's concept of metalanguage offers little more than a way of sort of classifying or reducing nonverbal operations into these rhetorical registers or rhetorical categories. Such a translation or such a classification is not really useful. In the sense that the desired condition or the desired distinction between criticism and mythification, or criticism and commentary, can't really go through yet unless the use of these rhetorical devices can be shown to demythify or subvert or criticize the language rather than just reproduce the language or revalidate it. The French critic Pierre Macherais has criticized this point as a hidden presumption of structuralism generally. He writes that the goal of all structuralist activity, whether reflexive or poetic, or we would say now whether a critical commentary of a verbal sort or a design production, that the goal of all structuralist activity is to construct an object in such a way as to manifest the rules that structure the object, to construct an object that makes manifest the rules by which it was constructed. Structure is, Macherais continues, in this sense, a simulacrum of the object. A simulacrum is something that, you know, simulates the form of an object but doesn't really have any material origin, okay? Macherais continues, when Barthes says that analysis elaborates a copy of the work, it must be understood that the work itself is already a copy. The object analyzed is considered as a simulacrum of a structure, but to rediscover this structure is to construct a simulacrum of the simulacrum. Now, of course, it's this spinning, again, a simulacrum of this spinning, this self-referentiality, this commenting and criticizing commentaries and criticism that Levi-Strauss called the effort to signify signification. It's the same sort of spin. So an architecture that returns to the architectural language is itself a substitute which has recourse only to another substitution. Part of the frustration... Now, to understand Silvetti's paradoxical claim, Bart stated succinctly the problem that I'm trying to get at, which the various debaters that we'll look at tonight attempt to grapple. Bart says, in a bourgeois society, there's neither proletarian culture nor proletarian morality nor proletarian art. Ideologically, all that is not bourgeois, all that is not consumerized, is obliged to borrow from the bourgeoisie. It's a measure of our present alienation that we constantly drift between the object and its demystification, powerless to render the object whole again. If we penetrate the object, if we unmask it, if we expose it, we liberate it, but we destroy it. And if we acknowledge its full weight, if we respect it, then we restore it to a state where it's still mystified. So it's this impossible paradox of working within an ideology, but being self-conscious about working within it, of alternately exposing and condoning, that Silvetti is grappling with. Bart enunciated the painful discovery that it's impossible to speak or impossible to design outside bourgeois culture and ideology. Marxism at this time, of course, provides the critical instruments for demythicizing cultural practices, for unmasking ideology, for demonstrating how seemingly natural or universal, presumably... Technology. Tafuri is unambiguous in his evaluation of these practices that attempt to return to the language. Tafuri says the return to language is a proof of failure. For him, for Tafuri, and I'm trying to pose Tafuri and Silvetti in a kind of debate, okay? For him, for Tafuri, there exist only two provisional, and ultimately they're impossible, or the provisional strategies for working within the condition of historically and ideologically imposed restrictions on architecture. But for Tafuri, these provisional strategies are themselves both equally unsatisfactory. Nevertheless, he goes through them. One provisional way is the Benjaminian program of the author as producer, that is, what Tafuri calls a consideration of the productive role of intellectual activities and the possible their possible contribution to some restructuring relations of production. That is, I mean, what we would think of Tafuri meaning is to do environmental planning or policy making or building construction, and to actually within those much more empirical empirical practices to somehow change the relations of production within the capitalist system, and not merely a consideration of architecture as a system of formal manipulation or symbolic manipulation. That's the first provisional working strategy that Tafuri lays out. And of course, all of this entails a reorganization and rethinking of architecture in the classical Marxist terms of division of labor and class struggle and all that along classical Marxist lines. Tafuri says that which criticism must ask of architecture is in what way will it, insofar as it's a precise organization, be able to influence the relations of production. So Tafuri in this provisional strategy is not worried about form making at all, but just like get in the streets. Now this, of course, is at odds with Silvetti's insistence that I'm quoting Silvetti, the production of a building the production of this physical thing, and the production of meaning, Silvetti says, are both parts of the production of architecture. So Silvetti and Tafuri here are explicitly at odds. Tafuri's second possible strategy is again provided by Roland Barthes, the strategy of white writing, or bleached writing, or writing degree zero, projected as a work from which all signs of class or group interest have been renunciated or bleached out or erased, and now interpreted by Tafuri in the work of Eisenman or Rossi as a desperate non-solution to this historical guilt or this historical contamination of contemporary architecture. Tafuri writes, "Today, he who is willing to make architecture speak is forced to rely on materials empty of all meaning. He is forced to reduce to degree zero all architectural ideology, all dreams of social function, and any utopian residues. Their purism, their rigorism, is that of someone driven to a desperate action that cannot be justified except from within itself." Now here, Tafuri's analysis, even though it's still critical of these practices, is actually more compatible with Silvetti's. It says a possible working strategy is to turn to this purism or rigorism from within, but with a very different prognosis. For Tafuri, the contemporary architect, on the one hand, has to learn his lessons from Mies or Loos, both of whom experimented with this language of emptiness and silence. Yet, for the contemporary architect, the translation of the sign of the well, for the contemporary architect, the meaning of this emptiness and silence was very different. For someone like Mies or Loos, this silence, this renunciation, still occurred within a material and historical context. That is to say, it still occurred as a radical negation of the city itself, of the context itself. For example, on Mises' Seagram's building, which I'm, sorry, not showing you, but rather the Federal Office Building in Chicago on the left and the earlier skyscraper project on the right, Tafuri says, "The almost nothing, Mises' almost nothing, has become the large glass." The reference here again is to Duchamp. "Reflecting images of the urban chaos that surrounds the timeless Miesian purity in a neutral mirror that tries to break up the city web. In this, architecture arrives at the ultimate limits of its own possibilities, like the last notes sounded by Dr. Faustus of Thomas Mann. Alienation, having now become absolute, testifies uniquely only to its own presence, separating itself from the world to declare the world's incurable malady." Now, clearly, this is not an endorsement of Mises' strategies so much as a description of Mises' strategies as a sign of the closure in the face of overwhelming historical forces. For Tafuri, it's a bleak and negative prognosis. There's no way out. We can still make silence, but it's an impossible and desperate solution. The contemporary architect who would follow Mies is condemned to by Tafuri to the political ineffectual domain of the boudoir. "In his hands," Tafuri writes, "the elements of the architectural tradition come suddenly to be reduced to enigmatic fragments, to mute signals of a language whose code has been lost, stuffed away casually in the desert of history. This would apparently exclude any attempt to question the language as a system of meanings, because it's just necessary to reveal it. And where contemporary architecture poses ostentatiously the problem of meaning, we must look for the signs of a regression." So in Rossi, for example, the categorical imperative of silence lives as this absolute alienation of form. The title of the Rossi drawing on your right is "Now Even This Is Lost," and it's Rossi's own desperate attempt, and even that is now broken and shattered to the point of achieving a kind of aura of emptiness, an experience of implacable reification of life through this return to emblems from Rossi's own oeuvre that's now have now been reduced to sort of ghostly fragments. And Tafuri's accusation of regressive utopia could be taken as a direct indictment of Silvetti's criticism from within. So we're left with the question, how then can architecture proceed under these present conditions of total reification? How can architecture escape this contamination of ideology? The third position, Silvetti's, Tafuri's, and now the third position in this matrix of debate, had in fact already appeared in September 1973 in the first issue of the journal Oppositions. Among the essays there in this first issue, it was the last, Diana Grest and Mario Gondazzonis' essay, Semiotics and Architecture, Ideological Consumption or Theoretical Work. It was that last essay that stood out for its intense theoretical language. Those readers of Oppositions will remember in Oppositions 3, half of the issue was devoted to responses to the essay. An intense theoretical language adopted from the militant Parisian Telkel group. It stood out for its thoroughgoing approach based on Marxist as well as structuralist principles, and it stood out for its searing criticism of Anglo-American absorptions of, and we would include, have to include Silvetti's in that, absorption of semiotics into architectural theories. That's not quite true. Its critique was actually of Charles Jenks and George Baird. The first footnote of the essay, this historical specificity is for Mark. The first footnote of the essay, which occurs in the second sentence of the essay, immediately directs us to our themes under consideration here. The second sentence, that his stage, their criticism of received architectural theories, begins: the function of these received theories, these theories that have been received down to this time, now, as always, has been to adapt architecture to the needs of Western social formations. Anytime a Marxist says Western social formations, that's bad, okay? Serving as the connection between the overall structure of society and its architecture. Now, the footnote I'm trying to get at, the footnote that defined this concept of social formation was to Louis Althusser's book, For Marx. Now, Althusser was a preeminent figure in France in the late 60s when Gondazzonis and Agresse were studying there. In the philosophical debates arising out of or surrounding May 68, his most celebrated essay, the one that I want to just mention here, is Ideology and Ideological State Apparatuses. And it provides the terms for a kind of last set of points to be made regarding ideology and the production of meaning before we then return back to Silvetti's argument. Now, I want to try using Althusser to specify now quite to specify this notion of ideology against the received Marxist notion of ideology as just false consciousness or a kind of set of mental illusions that veil the real nature and the real structure and the real consequences of material reality. Althusser posed an explication of ideology as itself a material system of social practices. Now, an inquiry into ideology entails not, for Althusser, entails not so much the identification and indictment or exposing of certain misconceptions, you know, false consciousness, so much as a study of the very media and the very forms in which cultural practices, whether they're religious, educational, juridical, or architectural, the study of the very medium and the very forms within which these cultural practices carry out their social function. Now, we've already seen how structuralism problematized the conception of the subject as an individual in control of his or her own creations. I mean, structuralism has already made problematic that notion of a spontaneous, self-creating individual subject. Now, Althusser is often referred to as a structuralist Marxist because for him, in his conception, a subject has no essential unity, but a subject, an individual, a self, is a product of many often conflicting social determinants, that we're determined not only by our language, but by often conflicting languages of social practice. A subject is just an effect, Althusser said, of the various structures and discourses that constitute it, but a subject still feels, as an individual, the subject may still feel free, may still feel autonomous, may still feel centered. Now, consider just as an example, less my own role in society as a teacher, a lecturer, an architect, a husband, et cetera. As far as society is concerned, as an individual, I'm utterly dispensable. Somebody else could have been the teacher or the husband or the architect. Even though someone has to fulfill the social functions that I carry out, there's no particular reason why I, rather than someone else, should be doing the things that I do. But of course, I don't feel dispensable. I don't feel like I'm merely an effect of the educational system or an effect of the discipline of architecture or of the institution of marriage, because these various institutions within which I perform my duties seem to me to value me personally. The church and the state value me because I have one wife and not 12. NCARB gave me a license to practice architecture with my name on it. The Cornell University Department of Architecture asked me to give these lectures. And each of these acts of legitimation enable me to act purposefully. These institutions don't so much police or repress my actions as they do affirm them, but within certain limits. It's as though society is not just an impersonal structure, but something that recognizes me personally and tells me that I'm valued, but also it makes me feel like an autonomous subject. So for Althusser, then, ideology is just this set of beliefs and actions and institutions that does this centering, the very material forms of these institutions that does this centering, that does this enabling but also constraining. Ideology is a subtle, pervasive, and unconscious medium in which I live out my relation to society. Ideology comprises the very signs, the very forms, the very materials, the very social practices, and the very disciplinary structures that bind me to the dominant social structure, but at the same time lends me a sense of coherence and identity. So it's in this sense that Althusser, ideology is a material force. Ideology is the material, the institutions, through which I imagine my relationship with society. Now, I mean, this can be seen in an educational system wherein elaborate formats. Think of architecture as a discipline, also as a mode of ideology, and think of architectural education. It has an elaborate the disciplinary structures, including the requirements for a license to practice, the study of architecture's history and disciplinary conventions, the isolation of the educational studio from other studies, the jury system of review, even the processes and instruments that we draw with and by which buildings are designed and constructed. All of these provide certain preconceptions, but they also achieve certain limited or permitted modes of seeing or saying or thinking, and they render others unthinkable or aberrant or extreme the famous comment, well, that's not architecture. I mean, right? The educational system itself puts boundaries. It enables architecture, but it also puts boundaries on it. And the evidence of ideology are these fixed patterns of belief, fixed imagery, each with its own structure, each with its own limits, but also with its own possibilities. So you can't do away with ideology. You need ideology to operate, but ideology also imposes limits. Now, with this conceptualization, Althusser then makes a distinction between ideology and knowledge. Remember the title of Gondelzonis and Agreste's essay, Theoretical Consumption. Ideological Consumption or Theoretical Work. And remember Silvetti's proposal that criticism from within is a production of knowledge. Now, Althusser makes a distinction between ideology and knowledge, or what he calls science. Now, he means by science something different. He means basically the acquisition of knowledge, okay? By which he differentiates the imaginary political function of ideologies, whose purpose is to secure the conditions for reproducing the forms and relations in the dominant society. He distinguishes that from the cognitive scientific function, which is to produce descriptions of real objects and the real nature and the real structure of those objects. Only on this condition that ideology and science are rigorously discriminated from each other is it possible that there be any knowledge. Okay. Now, the important thing for us here is this, that Agreste and Gondelzonis repeat exactly these Althusserian formulations, but now within the context of architecture, now distinguishing between architectural ideology and what they call architectural theory, which means the production of knowledge. Now, here's a long quotation from Gondelzonis and Agreste. This is exactly repeating Althusser. We propose that there is a need for a theory which should be clearly distinguished from the adaptive theory, or what we here call ideology, architectural ideology. Ideology has a social function of maintaining the overall structure of society by inducing people to accept in their consciousness the place and role assigned to them by this structure. At the same time, it works as an obstacle to real knowledge by preventing both the constitution of theory and its development. Its function is not to produce knowledge, but actively set itself against such production. Ideology, in a way, alludes to reality, but only offers an illusion of reality. In opposition to ideology, we propose a theory of architecture which is necessarily placed outside ideology. Now, that's the important thing, that what they're proposing is a theory that's placed outside ideology. The relationships then between theory and ideology might be viewed as a continuous struggle, where ideology defends knowledge, where ideology defends a type of knowledge whose major effect is a preservation of existing social systems, and architectural theory seeks to change those systems. Now, so Agreste and Gondelzonis maintain that theoretical work cannot be realized from within side ideology, but only from a theoretical outside separated off. It's at this crucial moment, the moment of insisting on theory as outside ideology, that Silvetti swerves away from the otherwise foundational arguments of Agreste and Gondelzonis. And Silvetti at this point swerves away and attempts to project a kind of provisionary practice in between the hegemonic and dominating force field of culture and disciplinary apparatuses and ideologies as analyzed by Agreste and Gondelzonis, and to get in between that and the implacable silence of Tafuri's closure, or implacable negation that Tafuri proposed. Now, the final concept for understanding Silvetti's proposal then can now be advanced, that architecture is operating within ideology, but at the same time producing knowledge. So it draws on Agreste and Gondelzonis. It wants to produce knowledge, but now not through theory outside ideology, but architecture operating within ideology. This is Silvetti. Perhaps what's most promising about criticism from within is precisely the awareness that we will not gain from it access to objective scientific knowledge, but rather through it we may aim at unfolding the imaginary symbolic universe that architecture simultaneously proposes and represses. The clear objective of criticism from within should be the production of a kind of qualified knowledge, even if short-lived, even if transitory, which will emerge as an apparition against a background of myths. So it's a very provisional, very transitory, very, very momentary kind of knowledge that Silvetti wants to produce. He says it should not be expected that the effects of a theory, in Gondozzonis in the Grest sense, will be achieved, but perhaps through the exercise of this criticism from within, it will be possible to produce the subtle subversion that Barthes suggests, the subversion that does not accept the play with opposites that are merely accomplices within the same structure, but one that seeks another term beyond the game, a term not of synthesis, but of eccentricity that frustrates the game. So what Silvetti is this provisional practice from within ideology that produces apparitions or subtle subversions at a symbolic level, not at the level of actual kind of take to the streets like Tafuri, but produces subversions at a symbolic level. Now again,